very beginning of Jeremiah chapter 1. The summer series that we're doing here is called Towering Lives, Terrifically Lived. And this is a study of the Old Testament prophet Jeremiah. And in Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 4, it says, "The word of the Lord came to me saying, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart, and I appointed you as a prophet to the nations." We spent our time last Sunday in these two verses talking about the power of that word before. Before you started forming in your mother's womb, God knew you. Before you were conceived, you were already known, and you were already loved, and you already existed in the mind of God. Before your mom and dad hooked up, and regardless of the circumstances surrounding that moment, whether it was true love or whether it was the biggest mistake in the world for them to be together, before that happened, God had a plan for you. And God had made an appointment for you to fulfill in your life. See, what we saw last week is that far too many people are living reduced stories way below their potential because they don't understand their before. They think that their before only stretches as far back as the night that their mom and dad had sex. And if that's as far back as our story goes, it can do a number on us. See, if mom and dad wanted me, if they were excited to have me, then I feel loved. If I was an accident or a surprise, I'm not sure how to feel exactly. And if they didn't want me, if my conception created stress or anxiety for them, if I brought grief to their life, if they considered aborting me, or if they gave me up for adoption, or if they've let me know that I ruined their lives with my birth, we can carry the marks of that for a very long time. Family of origin scars can go very deep, and they can take a long time for us to heal. And so this message from God to Jeremiah, which is a message to you and to me, is so healing. And it's so powerful and it's so liberating because God says before any of that happened, there was an entirely different narrative unfolding. It's like a person whose dad, or their mom, I suppose, too, never really figured out how to be a parent. And this this person conceived a child, but they didn't really know how to step up to the plate and be there. They never really got it together. Maybe they were always in trouble. Maybe they were damaged, and so they became damaging. Maybe they just didn't know what to do. Maybe they just were never there. And then imagine that this child who grows up doubting their legitimacy, wondering if they're actually worthy of being loved, this child one day gets on Ancestry.com and starts doing a little research, and they discover that my great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was a king, or a warrior, or a great healer, or a philosopher, or a statesman. And they start to realize, wait a second, that there was a different story back there that was bigger than my dad's brokenness. That there was a legacy that was greater than disowned or disappointed. And then imagine that they dig a little bit deeper and they discover an ancient family oath or decree. This ancestor king had made a proclamation at one point that the sons and daughters of this house are called to greatness. The daughters and the sons that will come from this family tree, no matter what happens to them in life, no matter how they get battered and bruised and beat up through life, they will always find a way to rise and overcome. Do you think that that might add a slightly different perspective? Do you think that might raise the chin of a discouraged child to know, wait a minute, you descended from royalty? You're the offspring of greatness. Do you think that might add a little swagger to the step? Over in Isaiah 51:1, it says, "Listen to me, you who pursue righteousness, you who seek the Lord. Look to the rock from which you were cut and the quarry from which you were hewn. Look to Abraham, your father, and to Sarah, who gave you birth. So over in Isaiah, he is saying to the northern kingdom of Israel, almost the exact same thing that Jeremiah was saying. See, at this point in history, this northern part of the country had so forgotten their before. They had so forgotten who they were that they were about to be conquered and exiled by the kingdom of Assyria. And so Isaiah comes up saying the same thing Jeremiah said. And he's like, wait a minute, don't forget your before. You have forgotten your story. You're Abraham's boy. You're Sarah's child. Your before stretched back. And Abraham and Sarah had been dead and gone 1,000 years by the time this happened. And he was trying to help the nation realize your before is deeper than you think it is. It goes clear back to the heart of God when he launched this whole nation through the promises of God. Don't forget your before. Don't forget who you are or whose you are. See, when we know who we are, when we know that our before stretches clear back to the mind and the heart and the passion of God, it changes everything. Kind of like when I got my first pair of glasses. I started wearing glasses when I was about 9. Anybody here beat 9? Anybody start younger than 9? It took a while for my parents to figure out that I needed glasses. I'd get really bad headaches and just kind of struggled, but we didn't know why for a while. And I will never forget when my dad took me to get my first pair of glasses, and I'll never forget the ride home in the car. I put those glasses on. They had the flexible hinges. They turned dark in the sun. They were as cool as you could get for a 9-year-old boy back in the day. But I was wearing these glasses, and I could not believe what I was seeing. I remember looking at my dad saying, do you see all those things on the trees over there? I had never seen the definition of leaves on the trees before. See, understanding our before is like having our vision come into focus for the first time. So for just a few minutes this morning, I want to talk about this a little bit more. I want to break down a little bit further what happens when we forget our before, because this was a central part of Jeremiah's message. If you want to ever understand that big hulking book, Jeremiah is the biggest book in the Bible. If you want to understand Jeremiah, you have to understand this idea of our before and what happens when we detach from the before. So scoot forward in your Bibles to Jeremiah chapter 3. Let me read you a couple of verses starting in verse 6. Jeremiah 3:6 says, "During the reign of King Josiah, the Lord said to me, 'Have you seen what faithless Israel has done? She has gone up on every high hill and under every spreading tree and has committed adultery there. I thought that after she had done all this, she would return to me, but she did not. And her unfaithful sister Judah saw it.'" Now, just remember quickly that at this point in Israel's history, there were two kingdoms inside Israel. Under the son of Solomon, when he became king, there was a civil war. The country broke in half. So we had the northern kingdom of Israel and then the southern kingdom of Judah. Verse 8, "I gave faithless Israel her certificate of divorce and I sent her away because of her adulteries." And that language refers to the exile that the northern kingdom went into with Assyria because they so forgot who they were, so indulged in practices apart from God's will that it became their downfall. "Yet I saw that her unfaithful sister Judah had no fear. She saw what happened up in the north, but she also went out and committed adultery. Because Israel's immorality mattered so little to her, she defiled the land and committed adultery with stone and wood. She committed adultery with sticks and stones. In spite of all this, her unfaithful sister Judah did not return to me with all her heart, but only in pretense, declares the Lord." Now, remember that this was happening during the reign of King Josiah. Josiah was probably the best king that Israel ever had. But when he came on the scene, the country had almost completely given in to idolatry and the worship of foreign gods and deities. And so the sexual language here, or the marriage language that's being used here, is used to describe a spiritual or a religious culture or dynamic that had saturated the entire country. So the adultery with sticks and stones was worship that was supposed to go to the one true God, but instead was being given to man-made idols made out of wood, made out of stones. The high hills and the spreading trees, the places where people committed adultery, those were the high places. Those were the alternate worship sites that were being built and set up all around the country. So instead of coming to the temple and worshiping God, you can just go wherever you want and worship whichever deity piques your interest. And this was in complete contrast to their calling. Do you remember Israel's Shema? That was their famous morning and evening declaration. And devout Jews would make this declaration, and it said, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your might, and with all your strength." Their entire existence as a nation was that they were unique. And out of all the nations in the world, God called Israel to know him and walk with him and be with him. There before stretched clear back to God's calling of Abraham when he left the idol worshiping culture of his father and then set out by faith for a whole new promised land. But Israel had forgotten their before. They had forgotten who they were, and so they started looking for it in all of the idolatry and all of the worship rites of the surrounding kingdoms. Now, they had so forgotten who they were and who their father was that this happened. Back up to chapter 2, verse 27. This is a description that God gives to them at this time. It says, "They say to wood," so to a wooden idol, "You are my father. They say to stone, you gave birth to me." Now, absorb the weight of those words for just a second. Israel had been conceived in the mind and the heart and the promise of Almighty God, and now they're saying to a stick, "Are you my dad?" They're saying to a stone, "Did you conceive me? Are you my source? Are you my before? Are you my attachment? Will you be my father? Can I attach to you and can I find life in you?" Let's switch metaphors. Back up to chapter 2, verse 13. God says this. He says, "My people have committed two sins. Number one, they have forsaken me, the spring of living water. And number two, then, they have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns that cannot hold water." So God's saying, listen, your first problem here, it's not even the fact that you're worshiping an idol. Your first problem is that you left me. You cut the cord that anchored you to your before. And yet, since you still need to attach somewhere, now you're trying to attach and find life in sticks and stones and these inferior man-made sources. And the result of this, it's like somebody who leaves a gushing, flowing, raging, artesian well of amazing, pure, life-giving water to drink out of a leaky cup or a cracked hydro flask. Do hydro flasks crack? I just got a hydro flask and it is awesome. It's I'm testing to see how long it'll hold on to an ice cube. But it's like leaving an artesian well to a cracked canteen. It doesn't work. And when that happens, when the counterfeit occurs, we're left with no other option. But we either humble ourselves and return to God, or we have to go looking for something else to provide life, because the leaky cup will only satisfy for a few sips. And listen, this pattern is always the reality where sin is concerned. You know, we talk about sin and missing the mark. Anytime we're thinking about that, we have to realize that the first sin is never the sinful act. The real sin is not what we do. The first sin is when we detach from the source. The only reason you're dabbling here and running there and looking there is because you've left him. We've left the source and it leaves us unsatisfied. I mean, haven't you ever seen people looking for love in all the wrong places? Have you ever been those people? Haven't you seen people trying to attach their identity to things that you know cannot satisfy them? And it's obvious to everybody around them. He is no good for you. This habit is hurting you. You are only masking your pain. You're not actually healing it. See, people overdrink and self-medicate because that's easier than actually engaging with the processes that bring true healing. People binge watch television. You know, it's a very interesting commentary on our culture today that binge watching is such a popular term. And I'm a binge watcher. We always love finding, okay, now which show can hook us to where we just can't stop? And it's fun, but it's also a commentary. We are binge watching other people living life because it's easier to go to the next one, quick, go to the next one, than actually get out there and do some living. It's easier to turn to porn than to actually cultivate real intimacy with an actual human being. And listen, the fundamental problem with these things is not, how dare you? Shame on you, bad boy, bad girl. No, that's not the fundamental issue. The issue is hold on. There's an artesian well here. There's life that you can drink from and wash in and be satisfied in, but instead you're trying to quench your thirst from a thimble. See, if you ever want to understand the prophecy books in the Bible, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Habakkuk, all those prophets that get so confusing, and now what are we talking about again, and which king, and which kingdom? You can summarize all of that in this simple statement. There is life right here. There's an artesian well right here. So please, would you come back from the puddle that you're lapping in? It's not going to satisfy. And the longer you try, the more and more life will fall apart on you until you're eventually swept away. That's the Gospels or the prophets in about 30 seconds. You've called a stone your source. You've called a stick your dad. And it has shrunk your world. Do any of you remember Shrinky Dinks? Anybody here remember playing with Shrinky Dinks? They were these really cool toys. I was so happy I found that picture because when I was a kid, I had a Mr. T Shrinky Dink. So if you're not familiar, they were these little art activities that you could do. You would get a little sheet of plastic that was maybe the size of a saucer or a small plate. And some of them were pre-printed, like with Mr. T's face, and you could color it in. Or if you were extremely talented, you got a blank sheet of plastic and you could do your own design. And you'd get it all filled in, you'd get it just right. Then you'd stick it in the oven and you crank up the heat, and the heat in the oven would shrink the palette until you came out with this little coin-sized piece of plastic. You could put it on your keychain, even though none of us had car keys back then when we were kids, or you could use it as jewelry. But that's exactly what happens. We go to the wrong source. And we're looking for art and beauty and life, but since it can't satisfy, when the heat comes, it shrinks us. And we have a whole world of people around us living shrunken, reduced lives. And then I want you to hear this. Listen to the heart of God. Oh my gosh. Look at how he responds in these moments. Go back to chapter 3, verse 12. Here's his response to this whole dynamic. Things are so grim. Israel had already fallen. Judah is on its way. Things could not be more grim. And this is what God says in verse 12. Go proclaim this message toward the north. Return, faithless Israel, declares the Lord. I will frown on you no longer. I will not be angry forever. Only acknowledge your guilt. You've rebelled against the Lord your God. You've scattered your favors to foreign gods under every spreading tree, and you have not obeyed me, declares the Lord. Verse 14, return, faithless people, declares the Lord. That word declares, return, faithless people, declares the Lord. That word means a formal proclamation or an oracle, which means that this is an official, bona fide, thus saith the Lord word. But just because it's a declaration, it doesn't mean that God is shouting this word or trumpeting this word. The word declares comes from a root word in the Hebrew language that means to whisper. Return to me, whispers the Lord. And the word for the Lord there in the Hebrew is the word Jehovah or Yahweh. That's the personal present tense name for God. Return to me, whispers Jehovah, whispers Yahweh. That this is the language of love. It's the language of relationship spoken with a tone of intimacy and tenderness. Come back to me. Listen, I don't want to be angry at you. Leave those alternate sources. Quit looking to a stick or a stone. Come back to me and live. Okay, I want you to think for a second about any area of your life where you might be attaching to an inferior source of life. Or think about any area where you might be self-medicating. And if you can't think of an area where you're doing this, then think about somebody else. That's okay to do that. If you have an issue, focus on your own issue. But if no issue readily surfaces, think about somebody you know, because certainly we all know somebody that this applies to. And I just want to take a few more minutes and I want to talk about how to reattach to life. And then I'm going to pray it and then I'm going to let you go. Verse 12, go proclaim this message toward the north, return. The word return, we'll do a little Hebrew word study here. The word return is the Hebrew word shub, S-H-U-W-B. And the word shub or the word return means to turn back, to turn toward, to turn away from. The word means in its definition to turn toward Jehovah. And at other times when the word is used and then we translate it into English, the word gets translated recede. As in floodwaters or an ocean tide that recedes and comes back to the point of departure. This Hebrew word shub means movement back to the place of departure. So to really understand this, you have to picture a dam holding back water. The picture of a dam where the water's contained, the water's being held. So keep in mind where we're going. This is God saying return. This is the definition of return. It's water that's in the proper boundary and it's being regulated and it's appropriate and it's providing life. But then you have to picture this dam cracking or a dam fracturing or breaking open somehow to where the water just starts gushing. And it's not regulated and directed. It's a free for all. It's a flood. It's dangerous. And if this happens too much, you end up with the water's gone. The water is spent. That sounded like a hydro flask. Is that a hydro flask? Just coffee cup. So the water's gone and it's just lost. Well, the word shub is the reversal of this entire process. So if we were watching this on video unfold, shub is all of these droplets of water, wherever they spread, being gathered up, scooped up, rolled back until they're back to the point of departure, back where there was life. And you know what's interesting? In Psalm 23, which we were singing today, when David said, "You restore my soul," the word restore is the Hebrew word shub. Which means that David was saying, God, when my soul, so my emotions, my intellect, my strength, my willpower, when my soul has left me, when something has cracked and fractured on the inside of me and I'm scattered and I'm lost and I'm all over the place, you gather up the fragments. You start picking up the pieces of soul. You start picking up the pieces of intellect and mental capacity and willpower. You start gathering all those up again and you bring them back to the place that they were before I burst. So step number one of how to reattach to the source. The first step is to ask him to start gathering up the fragments of life and soul that we've lost. Lord, I need to return. I'm like a tide that just got out of control and flooded the banks. Would you gather what I've lost along the way? Would you reattach me to life? So wherever I've dabbled, wherever I've spread, wherever I've attached to wrong places, God, I shub, I return like floodwaters moving back to the point of departure. That's number one. Number two, and this is important, see God smiling. Look at our verse again. Verse 12. Go proclaim this message toward the north. Return, Shub, come back to me, faithless Israel, and I will frown on you no longer. I will not be angry forever. God smiles in this moment because his child is coming home. I was going for a walk a couple of mornings ago, and I was praying through a psalm, which I do every day. I pray through a psalm, and this particular psalm was referencing sinners and God's mercy for sinners. And I paused on my walk and I just said, Jesus, thank you for dying for sinners. And as soon as I prayed that, I very clearly heard the Holy Spirit speak to my heart. I didn't die for sinners. I died for sons and daughters. And yes, of course, we were sinners. And scripture says we were sinners when he died for us. But he didn't die for us with the position of, all right, you miserable sinners, here I go on your behalf. No, he died for sons. I would die for my girls. How many of you would die for your kids? It was the love of a parent for a daughter or a son that took him to the cross. I didn't die for you wretched sinners. I died for you sons and daughters. And when you start to shub, God starts to smile because your kid is detaching from death and reattaching to life. See God smiling and ask him to gather up the fragments of soul that you've lost along the way. And then number three, and I only have four of these. Number three, cry guilty. Cry guilty. Verse 13 says, only acknowledge your guilt because you have rebelled against the Lord your God. You have scattered your favors to foreign gods. You have gone under every spreading tree and you have not obeyed me, declares the Lord. I don't know if it's an American thing or a human being thing, but it sure seems like we Americans love rebels, don't we? I mean, maybe it's because of our whole, you know, we rebelled against the British Empire at our founding. I don't know what it is, but it seems like there's something in our core that we just like to be a rebel and we like to cheer for the rebel. Have you ever watched a car chase, like a police car chase on television? I don't mean a cop show. I mean an actual chase. Do you ever have weird emotions when you're watching this? Because first of all, you're thinking, you are such an idiot. Where do you think you're going to go? I see you. I know right where you are. In fact, the whole city of LA knows right where you are right now. Oh, you made it down that corner. Great. We see you turning down that corner. So we have these emotions like, you're so stupid. Just pull the car over and cry guilty. On the other hand, do you ever just kind of think, okay, go a little further. I know you're not going to make it, but just a little bit further. But just a U-turn here and maybe you'll shake him for a few more seconds. I don't know. We kind of want the rebel to get away, but we also realize it's so ridiculous. The whole world sees what you're doing. Just cry guilty. We're guilty. See, the church has gone so overboard sometimes, harping on what's right and wrong and good and bad. And so we shy away sometimes from these kinds of scriptures. Listen, we are guilty. We sinned. We detached from the source. We attached to a stick, to a stone, to a relationship, a habit, a dependency. I'm a rebel. When Jessica and I were first married, we met a pastor from Ireland. He was from Belfast. Unbelievable teacher and very prophetic. He got up to teach. Our school of ministry was on a ministry tour, and this was crazy. We met this guy for the first time, and we had been doing all the ministering, but they asked this guy to speak to us to kind of pour back into us. And so we had about 50 young adults that were on this tour, and we'd spent the past 12 months together studying, doing service, taking Bible college classes. He gets up to preach, and he preaches a summary of everything we had learned throughout the year. He literally touched on obscure verses, had no idea what we'd been studying. He was super prophetic. But I remember he told us about a commitment that he and his close friends had made when they were growing up in faith. You have to have a friend who can speak into your life. If you don't have that, you're even more vulnerable to forgetting your before. But he said, we made a commitment to each other that we wouldn't be defensive when we got confronted. Even if I didn't agree, and even if we had to talk it out a little bit, if you start coming at me, my response is going to be guilty. If you say, hey, I need to talk to you about something, guilty. Not that we think we're miserable, wretched, constantly guilty people, but it's this idea of I'm quick to return. I'm quick to shoot. How do you condemn somebody who's so quick to cry guilty? When your kid cries guilty and they mean it, you melt. You stop frowning. That's what I was waiting for. So we ask him to gather up the fragments. We ask him to work in our lives. We see that he's not furious and mad at us. He's longing and he's smiling. And then we say, God, you're right. And this is more than, well, I forgot. I did forget. And then I chose and I willed to do this thing. I'm guilty. We need to cry guilty. And then number four, last point, we need to initiate a breakup. Now, have you noticed that churches tend to focus quite a lot on whether or not things are good or bad or right or wrong? Have you noticed that? And have you noticed that when something lands in the wrong or the bad category, there's not a whole lot of grace for it? Have you noticed that about us Christians? Have you noticed that if something's bad, if something's wrong, it's just bad and wrong and you got to get rid of it, period. I don't know that that's necessarily the best way to always deal with some of these things. Did you notice the kind of language that God used here? God is using the most tender, intimate, personal, emotional language here. See, God understands, and this might be helpful if we can catch this, that we can get emotionally attached to the things that aren't good for us. Do you know why it's sometimes so hard for people to give up their vices, even when the vices are bad for them? It's because those vices have become their friends. I know I drink too much. I know I can't stop with just one or two. And I know that when I drink too much, it does bad things to me and in me. And yet I've been turning to this for comfort for so long that it's become my friend. And so I know I need to let go, but I got to be honest, the thought of spending a vacation without it makes me sad. It makes me stressed. I'm not sure that I can do it. In fact, the thought of letting this go almost feels like a breakup. I know this thing. I know this person is not good for me. I know that. And yet I've gotten so attached that the unattaching is going to tear me. And see, when we're watching this happen, we usually think, well, it's bad. It's got to go. And we don't have a whole lot of compassion for the fact that it is a legitimate tearing. It's a legitimate wound sometimes to let go of the things that aren't good for us. Now, do we need to take the wound? Yes. Do we need to let it tear us? Yes, because it will kill us. Being torn is better than being destroyed. And yet, as we deal with this, it might be helpful if we give ourselves permission to grieve. If we give ourselves permission to be honest, and it's not just that's bad and I'm a rebel, that's one component. The other component is I've walked with these vices for so long. I've walked this way for so long that they've kind of become my boys. They've kind of become my gang, and it's going to hurt me to let it go. If you're willing to go there, if you're willing to grieve the breakup, it will help you actually break up. And then I don't know when the last time was that you broke up with somebody. But let me just remind you of a couple things. You know, in breakups, we usually say, oh, it's not you, it's me. Well, in this situation, it's definitely you. So if you're trying to get your head and your heart around this idea of detaching and reattaching, something's got to rise up in you that says, listen, no matter how difficult this is, you inferior source of life, you are not good for me. You are not God's best for me. You are leading me down a path that takes me away from him. And if he's life and I'm leaving him, where is that taking me? And so it's not me, it's you. And it's time to say goodbye. And then, you know, when we break up, sometimes people break up, but they want to still date once in a while. If you want to keep dating, don't break up. But if you're going to break up, you have to break up. And if you're going to break up, you can't keep dating. If you're going to break up, sometimes a clean break requires a clean break, which means you can't be commenting on the social media page. You can't be following what they're doing online because that just keeps this attachment there, even if it's a shorter attachment. If it requires a clean break, you've just got to go for the clean break. And then this is so important. I should do a whole sermon on this right here. Maybe I will. What are y'all doing next Sunday at 9:30? We need to trust that our new boyfriend, our new girlfriend, our new source of life is better. If God is better than the vices we have to lay down, God will be better. You know what the problem is with a lot of Christian stories? They sound like this. God pursued me. He worked in my life. He was all over me, and I finally surrendered to him. And when he did, I knew that I had to walk away from my old relationships. I had to stop doing this, and I couldn't go down there anymore. And what then? You listen to these stories and you're like, well, that can't be the end of the story. What did you replace those things with? What did you reattach to? See, we tell people to detach and unattach without telling them where they're reattaching, without telling them, hey, there's something vastly better. This smiling, wooing, loving, life-giving God vastly eclipses whatever we have to give up in order to receive him. This whispering, wooing, loving God is your life. We don't call people to leave the past and follow him so they can attend church once in a while. That's not life. That's not this abundant artesian well of life that brings you back from the dead and attaches you to a greater story. There's more. A towering life is a life that draws its life from the source of life. So you will never, ever live a towering life if you are routinely attaching to inferior sources of life, or if you are routinely self-medicating and applying band-aids that can't help you in the long run. We have to unattach and reattach and go all in with this God who knew us before. Would you stand with me? Let's reach for life. Let me end today just with a couple of words from Jesus Christ. I hate a sermon that doesn't circle back somehow to Jesus. Jesus said this in Matthew 13:44. He said, the kingdom of heaven. So that's the reality of life when we're attached to God. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again. And then in his joy, went and sold all that he had and bought the field. Again, in case you didn't get the message the first time, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. When he found one of great value, he went away and he sold everything he had and bought it. Jesus, we want to be that merchant in search of fine pearls. We want to be that person who has found treasure hidden in a field. And Lord, we're not doing this thing because it's an intellectual exercise. We're not living this life because somebody scared us with a teaching about hell. God, we're doing this life because you are life. You are treasure. Jesus, you are the pearl of great price. And so I pray you would help us to realize that you are worth any price that has to be paid to have you. You are worth any sacrifice that gets made along the way. Lord, would you help us today to have the courage to initiate the breakups wherever we need to do it? Flirtatious relationships, human relationships, emotional dependencies, thought patterns that we never let go of. Give us the courage to say no, to rip off the band-aid, to seek true healing. And then God, would you shub our lives? Would you restore us? Reattach us to life. Reattach us to holiness and the relief that comes from that. So today, Jesus, I just pray this for all of us in the room. God, would you wash our hearts clean? Give us clean consciences. Give us whole hearts that are filled with your love. Let us see you smiling. Let us live as daughters, as sons, as offspring of an incredible king. Let us carry this sense of dignity and worth everywhere we go. Let us impart it to every person we meet. And then God, since we are thinking today about people that we know that need this, wherever they are, reach them. Wherever they are, capture them and woo them and draw them. Let them hear the whispering voice of the great I am. We love you, Jesus. We so love you, and we want to love you more. Amen.